So I'm going to do my best not to overlap too much with Judith and Helen, although there are some common themes there. And the first being that I agree, before you can answer the question, you know, how we want to tax people that work in different ways, we have to answer the prior question is, what are we trying to achieve and what are we trying to address? So that could be, you know, decreasing revenues, is that a concern from increasing self-employment? Is it compliance? Is it just a compliance issue? Do self-employed people disclose their income tax and their income in the same way that employees are just automatically taxed by their employer? Or is it around the boundaries? You know, so and the boundaries are what I want to focus on over the next 10 minutes, actually. But it's also about protecting vulnerable workers and encouraging investment. So my position is a bit simpler, I think, than what we've heard so far. I want to keep all this in mind. I think it's going to be difficult for us to get to the same place that Sweden has got to, because our system has got so much baggage that comes with it. So, you know, a single rate of tax, Nick, may just be a bit too big an ask right now. I think 1% was hard enough. So I want to look and focus on the boundaries. So this slide is either, you know, just reflects the complexity of the issues, or it's just a very bad slide. But I think there are just four or five points I want to bring out. The first is that the status tests that we all know and love, I'm not going to go into them, you know, there they are. They have evolved over, and they keep changing. And I'm told by legal colleagues that, you know, the courts prefer a flexible approach to determining status so that the decisions can evolve with as working practices change. I mean, that's all very well, but I think taxpayers need certainty, you know, and it would be nice, you know, I don't know, for example, what mutuality of obligation means right now. Substitution seems to have evolved over time. And, you know, apart from the Pimlico Plumbers judgment, which has finally clarified it for me, you know, completely unfettered is good, but anything else is pretty much bad unless it's just checking on, sort of, you know, that you're suitably qualified. So that's it. I finally understand what substitution means. But it'd be nice if Pimlico Plumbers knew that in advance of that decision. So I think business needs certainty, taxpayers need certainty in advance. The next point would be Judith's point, actually, that, you know, we have deemed employment for certain groups. So agency workers are deemed to be employees, and we impose pay-as-you-earn on them. And it's a completely different test. It's nothing to do with employment status. They're not employees. It's all about supervision, direction, or control over how they go about their work, combined with personal service. So there is a different test, and we can deviate from employment status if we want to. Another test that I think is even simpler is the worker status, which does away with supervision, direction, and control and just asks, is the worker providing personal service? And then there's an exclusion if they are doing so through their own business undertaking. And there's some good case law on what business undertaking means. So there are two definitions there that we can start to think about. Maybe these provide us with alternative definitions for if we want to peg our tax regime to them. There's also other withholdings that we impose on the self-employed. Construction industry, foreign entertainers have been mentioned already. And sometimes we even charge class one NICs on the self-employed, in particular office cleaners and cleaners of telephone apparatus. Very important. So let's take a look at the first boundary, the employed, self-employed boundary. As Helen indicated, the gap there is what all the fuss is about. It's class one NICs, but the bulk of it, 99% of it, is employers' national insurance, not employees. It barely scratched the surface the proposed in the budget. And at that level there, the gap is about £10,000 at £170,000 of earnings. So quite a substantial gap. But the additional point I want to make about this slide is that gap also incentivizes people to incorporate, because the lowest rate of tax is the bottom red line, and that is the incorporated self-employment tax that people would pay if they incorporate, but they're not subject to IR35. So that trumps everything else. You get your best deal there. There's not much to be gained by a sole trader incorporating. As you can see, the lines are pretty much track each other. But an employee incorporating could do quite well if they then take their chances and they don't get caught for IR35. And as we know, HMRC has said there is 90% non-compliance with IR35, so it seems like a reasonable gamble to take. Now, that of course has been corrected in the public sector by new rules coming in from April that will basically mean that pay-as-you-earn and NIC has to be accounted for by the engager engaging the incorporated self-employed person if they pass the employment tests. And what this seems to have done to me is to create a boundary within a boundary, because now what you could say is that the green line represents the tax that will be payable by the private sector, and the red line represents the tax that will be payable by the public sector, or the other way around, sorry, if you're incorporated and you get away with your IR35. So the next boundary, I just want to, but I don't want to dwell on it for too long because it's already been covered. This is the boundary to do with employment rights and the benefits that people are entitled to depending on their status. I've left the agency workers out of this for now because it's just a simple point I want to make really. But of course, they're also protected by the Agency Workers Regulations and Working Time Directive. But the point I want to make here is that workers carry an entitlement to holiday pay, auto-enrolment pension contributions, and national living wage. Those are the financial entitlements they're entitled to. And therefore, even if you have equal tax and NIC rates to prevent people arbitraging the difference in status, you still have differences in employment rights with financial consequences. So that I can see that people, some engagers might still be tempted to leapfrog over worker and try and engage people on a self-employed basis to avoid having to pay holiday pay, pension contributions and national living wage. I'm not saying they do that, but I can see that they might be tempted to. So I just want to go back very quickly to what worker actually means. And it's provided to us a really good explanation provided to me anyway in the Byrne Brothers case, which was referred to in the Uber judgment. And this basically it's talking about, you're a worker if you're providing personal service, and then you can come out if you're actually carrying on a business undertaking. And what that is all about is looking at the difference between a worker whose degree of dependence is essentially the same as an employee versus contractors who basically are big enough and ugly enough to look after themselves. And I think that fundamental sort of policy principle is really important. And that's what I think if we start to look at the definition of worker and whether that definition is fit for purpose today, that's something that we might try and get back to. Of course, Clyde & Co, everyone will know that the Clyde & Co case sort of extended the definition of worker to LLP, partners in LLPs. Now, they're definitely big enough and ugly enough to look after themselves. So let's look at another boundary. This is the same graph that we looked at just now, but it's rolled forward to 2021. The reason why I wanted to put this up is because it reveals that the incentive to incorporate is even stronger by the time we get to 2021. So why is that? It's because the CT rate is coming down from 20% to 17% by 2021, and it creates a very big incentive to incorporate. So how big? I've plotted another graph. That could be the ugliest graph I've ever seen, but it does actually tell you what the difference is in earnings for the three legal forms, comparing 2021 with 16-17, based on what we know has been pledged in terms of tax bands and tax thresholds and rates. And you can see that the gap, let's just read something off. So the way to read this, let's look at the red line, that's the self-employed, incorporated, I'm abbreviating that to PSC, with a 17% rate of corporation tax at 100,000, it's about 3,500 better off because they paid £3,500 less tax in 2021. So I replotted this to see what it would look like if the corporation tax rate was 20%, and that's the line there. So changing the corporation tax rate doesn't just raise up the line, it tilts it. So you pay an increase, you benefit exponentially, which I thought was really interesting. And so this is where I'm going to sort of light the touch paper and then sort of make a run for it. And with a few suggestions about just what we can think about and what we can have a debate about later. And so what I'd like to suggest is the following, and these aren't necessarily the answers, but in terms of the worker definition, could we consider a new flat rate of withholding tax for workers? So that won't raise any revenues. So if we're trying to fix the problem that we're worrying about falling revenues, increasing self-employment, that won't help. But it will help with compliance, potentially. And we do it for SIS. So we have a precedent for doing that. If we want to protect revenues, then we might take that one stage further. And we might set pay-as-you-earn status at the worker level. So this is where I totally agree with Judith. There is no correlation between pay-as-you-earn status and employment status. It's totally arbitrary. So we can set that wherever we like, and we do with agency workers. So perhaps that we could take that one stage further and set it at the worker level. And the reason that might be attractive is just because it's a much easier definition, so it's harder for people to gain. And in terms of protecting vulnerable workers without strangling entrepreneurialism and job creation, I think if we just revisit the worker definition to make sure it focuses on the original policy intention and maybe broaden the exclusions so that people that don't need that protection are not brought into that regime, that could be helpful. And then in the middle column, the employed-self-employed boundary, perhaps we could just replace employment status with PAYE status and maybe consider a statutory test. Could be based on SDC like agencies or a worker definition adapted as I've been suggesting. Align class 1 primary and class 4 NIC rates, next parliament maybe. And ensure that those really carrying on their own business undertaking are properly recognised as self-employed and consider what investments we might provide to them. But as I've demonstrated, if you're incorporated, you're already getting 13.8% off, plus a really attractive corporation tax rate. And then finally, sole trader, I'm not sure what a sole trader is, but sole trader, perhaps we think about R35, that would be amended, that would follow the new pay-as-you-earn status. If we were to do that, then that would change with it. That would help at the help with compliance of the boundaries. But also, let's have a think about that corporation tax relief. If we're trying to what is that for? If you're a worker, if you're trying to reward investment return as opposed to labour, and you are a worker with your little PSC, but there's no real investment or entrepreneurship going on there, do we want that sort of person to benefit from the 17% corporation tax rate? And then finally, to remove that arbitrage on the incorporation and the boundary within the boundary, let's extend Chapter 10, the new rules for public sector workers, to the private sector. This is where I run for it. And over to Paul. Thank you very much.